start with a review of what you've done last week. So we've been trying to figure out how to describe a theory of strings rather than a theory of particles. So my purpose is to try to figure out how to generalize the notion of scattering amplitudes of particles to scattering amplitudes of strings. So try to build at least perturbatively a quantum theory of strings. Now, the main difference between a string and a particle is that the particle is a point-like object which has almost no degrees of freedom besides the center of mass motion, while a string has a lot of degrees of freedom. So a particle might be represented by a point moving in space-time. Perhaps it can have some extra degree of freedom, like a spin. But a string is something more complicated. So a string will have a center of mass, degree of freedom, which behaves like the position of a particle. But then it will have the other degrees of freedom that has to do with the oscillations of the string. And so classically, a string moving in space-time will be like a fluctuating blob. It moves along. Quantum mechanically, these oscillations are quantized. So like an harmonic oscillator, you get a bunch of states, excitation states for this string. In a sense, I mean, it's not the difference from what you have when you look at the nucleus, say. Now, if you look at the nucleus of an atom, there is a ground state, there are a bunch of excited states. And when you study the scattering of some nucleus, it may be that you send your nucleus in, not excited, and it comes out excited. But so in a theory of strings, so if you look at energies which are right, so comparable to the excitation energy of the string. So these strings could come in in the ground state, they could come out excited in various ways. Now each, roughly speaking, you can imagine each of these excitation states of the string it's its own particle, meaning each of these excited states of the strings behave more or less like a particle. If you leave them by themselves, they just maintain their identity. When they scatter, the string can be excited or unexcited, which behaves like some changes in the particles that are coming in or coming out. Now, this means that essentially every excitation state of the string will give rise at low energy to some field. So each of these excitation states of the string correspond to a single particle state of your string theory. And then from these particle states, you build fields. So they describe excitations with many particles or many strings. So typically you have a bunch of fields, each corresponding to one of the excited states of the string. Now, some of these excited states can carry space-time indices, might have non-trivial transformations under rotations. And correspondingly, these fields will carry space-time indices. So they might behave like vector bosons or, I don't know, gravitons or whatever. Now, by gauge fixing, by adding some extra degrees of freedom and then gauge fixing them, we managed to, in the first lecture, to transform the equations of motions of a string into a form which is very convenient, meaning that the states of the string end up being described as excited states of a bunch of free scalars which live on the string worksheet. So we have some Hilbert space of some free scalars. Now, inside this Hilbert space, there is a bunch of states which correspond to the physical states of the string. Inside the space of physical states, there are further some states that are null. which decouple from every calculation. So the final answer is that the single particle Hilbert space for the string ends up being described as some sort of a quotient . Now this, we described this quotient a bit by hand in a couple lectures ago. These are states that are annihilated by some modes of the stress tensor, and these were states that are generated by some modes of the stress tensor. In the next lecture, we'll do things a bit better with PRC quantization. So this will end up being something like a quotient between a Q closed states and Q exact states. So sorry, actually let me I want to stress out the actual Hilbert space of the strings on the string theory. Is the Fock space built out of that one particle Hilbert space? Now the space of states of string theory includes the vacuum, states with one string propagating, states with two strings propagating, at least perturbatively. So it's important to be careful and not to confuse the space of states of the of your free scalar theory, which uses an auxiliary tool to build the one particle Hilbert space of the string theory, and a space and the Hilbert space of string theory itself. The Hilbert space of string theory is much bigger. So the space H free scalars is also a Fock space. The Fock space of a two-dimensional quantum field theory. And then out of this, we built a one-particle states, and we built a Fock space of string theory, which is a Fock space of a quantum field theory in your target space, say in 26 dimensions, with infinite many fields, much bigger. Okay, but most of the time, we'll just think about the one-particle Hilbert space. After all, the sort of question we're trying to answer is, what happens if I take a bunch of one particle states of my strings coming from the past and have them scatter into some other states? So what we want to compute is sort of perturbative amplitude, the scattering amplitude. And the nice feature of string theory is that the interactions happen very naturally. You don't need to put them in by hand, but all you need to do is to sort of consider all possible ways to smoothly interpolate between them, between these histories, the incoming history and the outgoing history, by some Riemann surface, by some surface, two-dimensional worksheet with a bunch of tubes going to the future and a bunch of tubes coming from the past. So we want to compute this amplitude, which. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was trying to make a loop diagram. So I'm not sure this is very, I'm not very good at drawing two-dimensional surfaces. This is supposed to be a donut with a bunch of tubes. Is this a, sorry, no. I think I'm doing things even worse like that. Yeah, but. Probably made it worse, but yes.
Reminds me of what you said in the first lecture as the interaction between strings. Mm-hmm. You said that we will connect the strings like smoothly.
Yes.
Why is that the interaction considering this? I mean, the mm-hmm. most natural thing to do, right? But I mean, what's the physical meaning of that type of interaction?
It's a choice. So you could try to put by hand other interactions. It would probably not work. If it works, it will it's going to give you something that is more singular at high energy than string theory. So typically, if you have a quantum field theory, try to do a quantum field theory of gravity, say. What you've write down is non-renormalizable. It's going to have some thicknesses, some sufficient high energy. So whenever you do something that mimics gravity, sorry, that mimics quantum field theory, you're likely going to have trouble. So. Yes, but finally, yeah, that's right. So I'll have to sum over the genus, which is like the loop expansion of quantum field theory. So this is a, say, one loop, because there is one hole. Yes. Indeed. Well, so I would guess they would look like the strings coming in, becoming very tiny. And then something happening to them. Because it depends on how, you know, it depends on what you want to do. For example, if what you're adding is local in space-time, then, right, so you have your path, your strings becoming, we had to go all to the same point and then coming out of that point. So it looked like that. And then you have, you know, several of these points that come and collide, you'll get the singularities of quantum field theory. Here, there are no special points. OK. So so right, roughly, if you forget for a moment that we have to introduce Gauss and do things properly, the Hilbert space of or the free scalars is built from a ground state of specific center of mass momentum. Oh yes, well, really a family of infinite family of possible states where only the center of mass momentum is excited and no fluctuations modes of the string. And then the Fock space built out of them by exciting the string. There's a whole Fock space built from these basic momentum modes out of by using the oscillators. This index mu, Greek indices indicate indices in space-time. So there is Lorentz symmetry. acting on these indices. And inside this free scalar space, there are some physical states. For example, here, this guy should be square equal to 2. These guys are not in the string. These guys up to some polarization. So the physical spectrum of the string end up including a tachyon. So these states will be packaged together, can be packaged together as a single, or at least can be interpreted as a single particle state for one field, a tachyon field. Which mass with mass minus 2. These states can be collected together in the single particle states of a spin 2 field, massless, a massless 2 form, and a massless scalar, the dilaton. And then all the other fields, all the other states, give rise to state, to massive states. An infinite tower of massive states. And among these physical states, there are some which are null. So it turns out that all the states such that epsilon mu nu is p mu u nu plus u mu, sorry, p nu are null. Which, from the point of view of the fields for which these are single particle states, it means that these fields have a rich symmetry. Some of the single particle states of these fields decouple from the theory. And they are the states where sorry.
What are
U and V? So U and V are just some vectors, whatever vectors you want. So every time you can write a polarization in this form, this is a null state. Now, in going from here to here, I took the symmetric and anti-symmetric combination of the indices. So this spin true field accounts for the symmetrized one particle states. And this true form accounts for the anti-symmetrized. It's convenient, actually symmetrized and traceless. See, as we have a Lorentz symmetry acting on these states, it's convenient to decompose them in Lorentz, irreducible Lorentz, in the reducible representations of the Lorentz group. So this gauge symmetry is the gauge symmetry of a graviton. And this gauge symmetry is the gauge symmetry of some sort of weird generalization of a gauge field. And so this is the first manifestation of the fact that string theory always has a graviton. Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Well, yes, that's right. So on the worksheet, we had a big gauge symmetry I mean, which had to do with the fact that we had to introduce a metric to make the action in a way that was quantizable, that was the action of three scalars. And then we had to get rid of the diffeomorphisms and also wild transformations. So this big gauge freedom up here turns out into a bunch of gauge freedoms for all the states in your, I mean, it tells you that the Hilbert space of what the of one particle states has a sort of form where you have to decouple the null states. And right, so that manifests itself into gauge freedoms at the level of the fields that come out of a string. Actually, for the massive fields, this sort of freedom, these null states. See, the point is, for the massive fields, the null states come into full massive representation of the Poincaré group. Just throw them away, and you're left with some other massive representation of the Lorentz group. But for massless states, things are a little bit more subtle, and the null states give rise to a gauge freedom, meaning that if there is no way to throw them away by hand and leave everything Lorentz invariant. If you want to get rid of them, you need to really do a proper gauge fixing. And actually, amusingly, when you gauge fix, things appear properly by using the ghosts. If I'm not mistaken, you actually automatically get the ghosts that you need to gauge fix things downstairs in space-time. So once you, but this is for tomorrow. So tomorrow we'll do the gauge fixing with all the bells and whistles. For now, let's just focus on the review. So, how did this sort of structure come about in the first lecture? So we started with some very basic proposal for the action for the strings, what's called the Namogoto action, where roughly the action. Where the action was essentially the area of this surface. Now, quantizing that was too complicated because it's a nonlinear expression. But there is a better option, which is to use the Polyakov action, which is an action which classically reduces to the area action, but is reasonably straightforward to quantize. So the Polyakov action is natural for a bunch of scalar fields which describe the position of your surface in space-time. So you can imagine them as maps from the surface sigma space-time. And as some auxiliary degrees of freedom, which are a metric on the Riemann surface. These are the degrees of freedom. The action is essentially the simplest action you can write for these degrees of freedom. for the scalar fields in the presence of a metric. Which is this. I'm raising a lower indices with the implicitly with the Lorentz matrix. Okay. Now this action has a lot of nice symmetries. First of all, it's written in such a way that it's invariant under coordinate transformations. So it has a symmetry which are diffeomorphisms. They're generated by some vector fields on your surface. And they transform your fields by diffeomorphism. And your metric. Also by the diffeomorphism. Okay. Notice here I've lowered some indices using the metric. So the metric on the surface. Now, this is sort of expected. What's unexpected is that this theory also has a wild symmetry. This is very special of two-dimensional worksheets, and it's essentially the reason for which you can do string theory, but we don't know how to do membrane theory, say. Wild symmetry is very simple. It just rescales the metric. So because of the symmetries, it means that there is a lot of redundance. If I try to do my path integral, this is a path integral over the fields. And the metric. I'm going to get a big infinity because of this redundancy. So what we actually want to do is somehow divide out by the diffeomorphisms and wild transformations. That is a sort of formal statement, but that is to gauge fix this path integral, this formal path integral until you get something that is actually meaningful. Now, here you encounter a possible problem. These are classical symmetries. They're symmetries of your action. They may or not be symmetries of your measure. Now, as I was mentioning, usually when you have troubles with a quantum measure, the troubles can jump all over the place. It's up to you to decide how to regularize it. If you make different choices of how to regularize it, you might find problems in different locations. Now, typically, when you have a metric on your worksheet, there is a very convenient way to regularize, which is to sort of put the cutoff, throwing away all the modes that fluctuate with a wavelength shorter than some fixed distance on the worksheet. Now, this definition implicitly uses the distance on the worksheet, so it uses the metric. So there is nice regularization. Uh, which is cutoff based on distance. Now, because the definition of the distance is diffeomorphism invariant, this cutoff leaves diffeomorphism invariance preserved. Because we haven't made any strange choice treating some scalars different from some other scalars, is automatically Lorentz invariant. But because we use the metric, you can imagine troubles with my wild transformations. So because of that, it's actually natural to first gauge fix the diffeomorphisms and see what happens. Now, yes, on Friday we studied BRST quantization. So we learned how to gauge fix symmetries with ghosts and BRST symmetry. So if you do that for the diffeomorphism, so you remember you had to introduce some ghosts for the symmetries, some ghosts for your gauge fixing conditions. Now, which sort of gauge fixing condition can we use to gauge fix the diffeomorphisms? Now, there is a nice theorem. Should we have a free blackboard here? So the theorem is that up to the diffeomorphisms, every metric on a surface can be put to this form locally. And you can join the patches by holomorphic transformations. The holomorphic coordinate transformation changes your metric in a very nice way. So it lives in particular, it lives in this nice form. It just rescales your choice of shifts your scale of the choice of wild factor. So pretty much it means that for gauge fixing, all I want to do is to set h zz to 0 and h z bar to 0. Now you could complain that this doesn't quite fix all the diffeomorphisms, because after all, I can still do these sort of transformations that leave the metric in that form. But although these transformations are always available locally to glue patches together, it's actually pretty rare to have a globally defined holomorphic coordinate transformation on your surface. If they exist, there is just a handful of them, and you can just deal by them, with them by hand. But not really by hand. Deal with them properly in the context of the BRST quantization. And we'll learn how to do that. So does that mean? It pretty much means that I want to insert formally something like this. And and then I'm going to have to add something involving the ghosts. For this glitch fixing. Again, I'm not going to go into details today. The details will work there. We'll regard the details tomorrow. But roughly, you get a ghost for every glitch fixing condition. A big ghost for every condition, and a C ghost for every diffeomorphism. Okay. So after you do that, you can pretty much forget about the diffeomorphisms. You're only left with the problem of dealing with this wild symmetry. Of course, now there are also ghosts. But integral. Okay. Okay. So now one is ready to figure out what's going to happen to the wild symmetry. So the question is this path integral now going to be wild invariant? Now, it's actually nice that, as I remarked, the wild factor completely drops out of the action for the scalars. It actually drops out also from the action from the ghosts. So essentially, that means that the procedure of gauge fixing the diffeomorphism has not introduced any violations of wild symmetry. Or at least if there are any violations, they must be hidden in the path integral for the ghosts themselves. Okay. So the question that's left is the product of this and this wild invariant? So from the scalar fields, it's just a calculation. You put it here, you get something like the ZDZ bar of the axis. Here you can get HGZ bar with upper indices, which is the inverse of HGZ bar with lower indices. And the determinant of the matrix is, again, HGZ bar. So this cancels out against this. For the ghosts, it's a calculation. We have not computed the ghost action yet, so we'll see it tomorrow. Now, it turns out that the violation of wild symmetry can be captured just by one number, meaning that this whole action is going to transform. So if you do a wild transformation, this whole action transforms by some functional. Of your while. So if you do a while transform, sorry. I want to write it correctly, sorry. So if you do a while transformation in parameter epsilon, your measure transforms in a very specific way. With a specific number in front. And so the form of the transformation is always the same, essentially, no matter what is your two-dimensional field theory, while invariant, classically while invariant field theory. The number depends on your theory. Mm-hmm.
If HGZ bar drops out, what changes when we do the wild transformation?
The measure. So HGC bar is still important to define the distance. So to define your cutoff. And depending on how much time we have, I can be quite explicit about that. So the point is that this number, which is called central charge, receives some contribution from the excess and some contribution from the ghosts. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. No, so this is something that you pick in front of the measure. So this f of epsilon is some function of epsilon. I could be more specific, but I have to remember it by heart. I didn't write it down, unfortunately. It's something like del del bar epsilon plus, what was it? Roughly plus epsilon, square root of h epsilon or something like that. Roughly, okay. You can always compute it as an exercise. So the point is that each of the scalar fields contributes one to this number. The ghost's contribution will compute tomorrow and is minus 26. So the result is that if and only if you have 26 scalar fields, then the total C is zero. So your measure is well invariant, your action is well invariant, and pretty much you get rid of your HGC bar right away. Because after all, the wild transformation only acts on HGC bar and just rescale it. So you can just use them to get rid of it. Okay, in principle, you could do it with all the bells and whistles, you know, really add a ghost for the wild transformation, but wild symmetry gauge fix it, but in the end, you just get nothing. So there's no point doing it. Okay, so how do we learn what is the, at least how do we detect that there is a violation of wild symmetry, say in the theory of a free scalar or the theory of the ghosts? And how do we quantify that violation? Now, a good way to do it is by looking at the properties of the stress tensor. See, classically the stress tensor just by definition captures the changes in your action under a change of the metric. Let's say the stress tensor for the scalar fields. Or maybe I should put it up here. Quantum mechanically, there is a stress tensor operator which is roughly doing the same thing, meaning that if you have a correlation functions of a bunch of operators, in the presence of a specific metric, then the insertion of the stress tensor should be the same as the variation of your correlation function with respect of a variation of the metric. Up possibly to some contact terms which have to do with the fact that the definition, the very definition of your operators might actually depend on your definition on your Shostov metric. So this is a classical. This is a quantum mechanical. Okay. Now, as a consequence of the homomorphism invariance, the stress tensor is conserved, which classically means something like that. Quantum mechanically means that if you insert the divergence of the insertion of the stress tensor, you get zero up to contact terms. Which means that the divergence stress tensor inserted in your correlation function gives you essentially zero up to some contributions at the, which appear only if your stress tensor was really colliding with some of the operators, in which case it gives you the action of this, gives you a translation of the operator, the action of the diffeomorphism over your operator. And for a while, classically, if a wild symmetry is a classical symmetry, you expect the trace of the stress tensor to be zero. Quantum mechanically, if a wild symmetry is a symmetry of your theory, you expect again the trace of the stress tensor to be zero up to contact terms. Which come about because the definition of your operator might not be wild invariant. Typically, if you have an operator, a classical operator, when you try to define a quantum operator, classical expression, you try to define a quantum operator, there might be some divergences, there might be some regularization like point splitting. And this regularization usually implicitly uses the metric. So the definition of your operator might change under a wild transformation. Okay. Now the sort of contact terms, these sort of delta functions that only appear when your operator is sitting on top of something else, are typically they're well defined up to a lot of freedom in redefining your operators. But sometimes you can make some rigorous statements about them. Clearly, you cannot really detect them if your operators are just sitting at different points. But you can detect them if you say, consider deforming your action by the integral of some operator over your whole space, because then this integral is going to pick up the delta functions. So let's see if we can see some manifestation of these things. So let's see if you can really see that, say, the stress, the trace of the stress tensor is not going to be truly zero in a correlation function if your metric is not flat or something like that. So and let's do it in the free scalar theory, which is rather simple to understand. So as you remember, we gave a definition of the stress tensor. Just call it S because. So remember, last in the second lecture, I think we were working on the cylinder. We studied the free scalar on the cylinder, and we learned how to compute correlation functions of various operators. Okay. So we give this definition. Now, there is a lot going on implicitly under this definition. See, we use this to cancel the singularity. This is implicitly assuming that we are working with a flat metric on the cylinder. So, you can imagine that if you start changing the metric by wild transformation, you might get different regularizations and maybe get into some trouble. But let's try to do something rigorous. So for example, let's compute a two-point function of the stress tensor. On the cylinder. So again, so I have my space time, I put a vacuum in the past and in the future. I pick 2 points S and S prime and put a stress tensor at each of them. Okay. I can do this computation directly from the definition, or I can do it by using the Virasoro algebra, which we also computed in previous lecture. Together with the fact that positive modes kill the vacuum. Okay. So I can just plug in the definition, the Fourier expansion of the stress tensor. Okay. I can plug it here. A lot of terms will just drop out because the positive L's kill this and negative L's kill that. And the terms that don't, in the terms that don't drop out immediately, I can use the commutation relation to bring, say, a negative guy from here to here, and then it kills the other side. So all that you're left with are the contributions from the commutator. More precisely, only the commutators which give me something which don't kill everything. Doesn't kill everything. Sorry, actually I should just put this. Sorry. Okay. So what you actually get, it's something like contributions from the constant part only. All these else ultimately kill the vacuum. Okay, so what I thought was correct, sorry. Okay.
With respect to the relations in the world up there, do you need to worry about, we didn't mention anything about normal order.
True.
Do we need to worry about what we write down or do we need to worry about which order?
Pick your definition. That's why I put these deltas. Pick your definition of operators. As long as the operator make, as long as the definition makes sense, then these equalities are true. If you use a different definition, wait, sorry, and of the operators, you get slightly different variations there. Now, you can ask, what about the definition of the stress tensor? Perhaps this is what you were asking, sorry. You're right, sorry. Yes, yes, that's correct. So what are we doing here? See, by regularizing the stress tensor, what we're really doing is essentially defining the measure of my path integral implicitly. At least there is an implicit definition of how the measure is going to change when I change the metric. If you want to define the stress tensor in flat space, then if I want to know what is the stress tensor in some other metric, or if I want to do a change in the metric, I can insert this stress tensor and see what happens. Sorry, I'm not saying it very well. Let me say it better. So suppose you regularize your stress tensor in different ways. What's the result? So all the regularization will differ by adding some C number to your stress tensor, something that is not an operator, something that is the number. So if you insert a stress tensor with different regularizations inside these correlation functions, what's going to give to you is an extra term. So if I change the regularization, I'm going to change the answer by a multiple of the correlation function of these operators. So you can sort of try to reabsorb it in a redefinition of your measure of integration, which is hidden. So if you redefine your measure by a scalar, by a number, that will exactly have this effect. Every correlation function will be multiplied by that number. So, so if you pick two different definitions of your stress tensor, they can be related by, so they're related by a finite shift, a well-defined shift, which can be absorbed into a well-defined rescaling of your measure, of your correlation function. And notice usually when you correlation functions, you actually divide by the correlation function of nothing. So typically the sort of factor will actually oscillate up out. But we don't want to do that because we're actually exactly interested in how the correlation function depends on the metric. So we want our nothing to be, say, one, no matter, to remain the same when I do a wild transformation. Okay. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Just plug the definition. There is nothing at this point. There is, I don't want to say anything different than that. It's just an observation that if you want, I can put the minus one here. Nothing changes in the analysis. So let me try to say it better. So suppose that this expression without the regularization made sense. Okay, it doesn't quite, but suppose it made sense. And it corresponded to some well-defined measure. Then this changes in the stress tensor just gives you an overall rescaling of the measure. You've absorbed an overall rescaling of the measure. Now, that measure actually didn't make sense. It was some infinity. It had to be regularized. And similarly, this didn't make sense. So I'm claiming that this, the shift, the rescaling of the measure corresponds to the shift of the stress tensor, is exactly what regularizes the measure and regularizes the stress tensor. But okay, so let me just time is short. So let me just say, when I pick the regularization of the stress tensor, I picked implicitly a regularization of my measure. Okay. So now let me compute this two-point function. So you're gonna get something like this. Check me on that. But so the final answer is supposed to be after constant. So what I wanted to get to was just the statement that if there was no central charge, the two-point function of the stress tensors would be very mild, would be just some constant, no singularities. But because there is a central charge, then you get a singularity in the two-point function of the stress tensors. Now, why should this worry me? Well, suppose I'm trying to check conservation, the diffeomorphism invariance. Okay? Diffeomorphism invariance is the statement that del bar, del S bar TSS plus del S TSS bar is zero. Okay. And if I try to do it here, so I try to do it inside this correlation function. See, the del S bar acting on this almost gives me zero, right? It gives zero everywhere, except when S and S prime coincide. So roughly, right here, the S of this correlation function gives you something proportional to the third derivative of a delta function. See, I'm using essentially the fact that del bar of 1 over S minus S prime is just the delta function. Now here I have a divergence of order 4, so I can get it from here by doing 3 derivatives. So in general, so now this doesn't look very good, because inside this sort of Ward identity for diffeomorphisms, we're supposed to just get translations, the effect of the diffeomorphisms on my stress tensor. And we want our definition of the measure and of correlation function to be invariant under diffeomorphisms. So to compensate for this, I need to also define my T of SS bar in such a way that it cancels this. Luckily, this is a derivative respect of S, so it's actually rather straightforward. Okay. So whatever is my definition of the measure, if I want to do things in a way that is diffeomorphism invariant, I'll have my T of SS bar will have some contact terms with my first tensor. Now, all of this was done in a flat metric. Now, suppose I want to change my but I can use this to compute the expectation value of TSS bar in the presence of a metric which is infinitesimally close to being flat. So if I do the calculation in the presence of a metric which is infinitesimally close to the flat metric, then I'm going to get something like that. So you see, this is a way to understand why people say that this central charge which appears here in the Virasoro algebra is related to the lack of wild symmetry of your theory.
Mm-hmm. When you write
TS bar, should be TS bar as bar, right? No, SS bar. Sorry, I remember that if I want to change the S bar component of the metric, I need to add SS because we raise indices with the.
Sure, but in the flat metric, TS S bar is zero because of the traces.
Classically.
Oh, okay.
So this is showing you that if you want to do things in the quantum theory in a way that is invariant, where things are invariant under diffeomorphisms, and you have a central charge in your Virasoro algebra, you are going to get in trouble with wild symmetry because the one-point function of your trace of the stress tensor will actually be non-zero if there is a non-trivial metric on your manifold. This is only infinitesimal. The full statement is that TSS bar is proportional to the central charge times the Ricci scalar. So this is the full statement. It's called the wild anomaly. So generally, quantum field theories, which are classically wild invariant, you get this sort of quantum expressions where the stress of the stress tensor is equal to some complicated some polynomial in the curvature. In two dimensions, this is the statement. In aggregate dimension is more complicated and you get more numbers. Okay, sorry, I went wildly over time. Well, I mean, this was a sort of a very roundabout way to learn about wild problems with TSS bar, starting with things we know about TSS. TSS is fine. It's fine. Well, fine. Kind of fine. No, TSS is fine.
When you write TSS bar, that's an operator statement, right? I
mean, yes.
That's only valid under taking the average.
Yes, so if you want, presumably, if we did this in point splitting, we would have ended up with the same result. So if you'd done the two-point function of del x, well, sorry, it's tough to say, right? So I mean, the classical expression of TSS bar is just zero, but it's zero if you use the equations of motion. So this list opens the possibility that if you do the calculation in point splitting and then you try to regularizing properly in the presence of a metric, you will actually get something which is not zero. Because after all, the equation of motion themselves are valid up to corrections. But I did not do the calculation, so actually this statement might be not correct. I invite you to check if you can actually verify this. In a sense, right, the point is you need to pick a regularization of your TSS bar that, no matter what, preserves the word identity. So you pick your normalization of TSS, you pick your normalization of TSS bar, however you want, as long as this is true. And then it should be true that if you do it with a generic metric, you end up with something non-zero.